Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, Irish stories from the First World War, including the exploits of the Irish Flying Aces, the remarkable life of an adventurer who helped elect an American president and who later broke the story of the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun, Irish Jesuits in penal times, the British politician who helped found the National University of Ireland and who was forced from office in 1915 after being vilified as a German sympathiser. And then to end the show, we'll explore the history of books from the ancient world to the digital present. Last week, we celebrated the 250th anniversary of the birth of Beethoven by looking at his remarkable life and music. And if you want to listen back, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. We begin tonight's show with stories of Irishmen in the First World War. Between 1914 and 1918, 200,000 Irishmen from all religions and backgrounds went to war. At least 35,000 never came home. Those that did were scarred for the rest of their lives. Many of these survivors found themselves abandoned and ostracised by their countrymen, their voices seldom heard. And the story of the Irish who served has now been told in a new book, A Coward If I Return, A Hero If I Fall, Stories of Irishmen in World War One. It's published in paperback by the O'Brien Press and costs €18.99. The author is Neil Richardson. And Neil, thanks a million for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Can I begin by talking about Ireland's Flying Aces? Because that's a part of the story of the Irish in the First World War that I wasn't familiar with.
Well, the Irish Flying Aces, I suppose what's little known is that we actually have the highest scoring and third highest scoring Irish Air Aces of the British forces in the First World War come from the island of Ireland. So it was an embryonic form of warfare in 1914, the idea that guys would take to the sky in these fairly new machines, put weapons on them, and all of a sudden they become sort of not dissimilar to the knights of old, kind of going one-on-one against enemy pilots in the sky. Guys on the ground would have seen them as almost superheroes or the astronauts of the day, if you want to look at it from that perspective. But a chap by the name of Edward Mannock, who was known as Mick Mannock, became the British highest scoring air ace of the First World War. And not far behind him in sort of overall third place was a chap by the name of George McElroy from Donnybrook in Dublin. McElroy would have actually been trained by Mannock. And what's quite poignant is that they would have died within a week of one another in July of 1918. So it was quite a short life, both men still being quite young. But yes, the embryonic form of warfare, aerial warfare, was sort of dominated by Irishmen in terms of the British forces in the First World War.
Talk to me as well then about the first Victoria Cross, because again, there's a strong connection.
Well, the first Victoria Cross was earned during the first Battle of the First World War, the Battle of Mons in August 1914. And it was earned by a man by the name of Lieutenant Maurice Dees from just outside Castle Pollard in County Westmeath. So he had been tasked with guarding a bridge, the Nemi Railway Bridge, just outside of Mons, and to stop the Germans from advancing across this bridge. So he set up his machine guns on his side of the bridge and would have opened fire, obviously, when the Germans came on. During the course of the day of the Battle of Mons, he was wounded about five times and was last seen alive, personally firing one of his machine guns. Now, as an officer, it wouldn't necessarily have been his job to do that, but apparently all of his gunners had been killed or wounded at this point and had been withdrawn to the rear. So Dees's body was later recovered by the Germans. It seems that he may have tried to crawl away to get some sort of medical help when finally he couldn't fight on any longer. And he was buried with full military honours. He was awarded the first Victoria Cross of the First World War. Obviously, unfortunately, he had passed away at this stage. He was from Westmeath.
And there are some wonderful photographs and items of memorabilia that you've included in the book. Did you find that the fact that we passed the centenary of the war, that the various commemorations and the way people now approach Irish service in the First World War has maybe changed the way we view it, but also has brought new materials to light?
Well, certainly. I think maybe in the past, definitely prior to the centenary period, people didn't necessarily know what they had. And I often found when I was researching the book, so around 2008, 9, 10, or that period, that people may have presented medals to me that they might have thought were First World War medals and perhaps turned out to be Irish Army medals from a different period. But obviously the period of the centenary would have educated people, for lack of a better phrase, as to what was in their attics. And certainly people started coming forward with medals, with stories, diaries, often kept in the dark for nearly 100 years, would appear in families. And I also think the centenary period, and especially the discussions that would have been going on in the media and the books that would have been getting published quite regularly, made people feel that it was okay to start talking about this stuff and bring it to light. So I think definitely the centenary period sort of made a sense of openness about talking about our involvement in the First World War.
And finally, the title of the book, A Coward If I Return, A Hero If I Fall. Was that how these people were viewed?
Well, the title, I was inspired to pick that title from a poem called A Lament by the Irish war poet Patrick McGill. The McGill Summer School, obviously up in Donegal, is named after him, and he served in the London Irish Rifles. Yes, in many cases, if these guys had passed away overseas or had been killed in action, their family could view them as a sort of a hero in a quasi struggle for a form of Irish independence in the form of home rule. When they came back, Ireland had changed quite politically by then. So those guys who lived on into the 1920s and became old men in later years, Ireland had so drastically politically changed that maybe they were perceived as cowards for having fought in the wrong army in the wrong war. I would hope that the First World War centenary period definitely put that to rest.
Okay, well, congratulations on the book. It's called A Coward If I Return, A Hero If I Fall, Stories of Irish Men in World War One, published in paperback by the O'Brien Press. It costs €18.99. The author, Neil Richardson. And Neil, thanks a million for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. The life of Sir Harry Perry Robinson unfolds like a boy's own adventure, and it brings in the White House, Buckingham Palace, the American West, the Western Front, the tomb of Tutankhamun, and lots more besides. Harry was a master of reinvention, and his life was a grand life lived in history's shadow. And it's been told brilliantly in a new book, Escape Artist, The Nine Lives of Harry Perry Robinson. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author is Joseph McAleer. And Joseph, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you, Patrick. Nice to talk with you.
Can we get a kind of a sense of this extraordinary figure? Because he is someone that you could see making, you could make a 20-part television series about him, because it is like the young Indiana Jones chronicles, the way he goes from the 1896 presidential election to the First World War to the sands of Egypt. And it's an extraordinary life and an extraordinary series of careers.
It was. He was a man who lived in the shadow of history. He influenced so many historical events, and yet no one has ever heard of him, which I found absolutely fascinating. I mean, as you know, as a historian, you channel your inner detective. What child doesn't want to be a detective growing up? And that's why you become a historian. And in this case, I marveled at how, as you say, he just progressed from one incredible life to the next, had many setbacks along the way, but wound up living a life of many different people. And that made it more all the more interesting for me as a historian.
So he was born in India, educated at Oxford, but I want to talk about his experiences in the United States, where he went off to make his name and his fortune, because he was involved in gold mining, involved in the railroad industry. But I want to talk about his role in the 1896 presidential election. How did he help William McKinley win that election?
Well, as you say, he flunked out of Oxford and he decided to go and make his fame and fortune in America. Became a journalist, found himself out west, and fell in love with the West. Landed in Minneapolis and worked in newspapers and publishing, got very interested in the railroad industry, wound up marrying the daughter of the richest man in Minneapolis, who gave the happy couple a wedding gift of $5 million today. And with that, he bought the leading industry publication called The Railway Age, based in Chicago. And in the 1896 election, which is probably known, it's considered the first modern presidential election in America because of its techniques of kind of blanket communication, propaganda, really inundating the electorate. A lot of the voters for the Republican ticket of William McKinley were laborers, in particular on the railroads, which was quite an important industry at the time. And Harry Perry Robinson found himself in the role of a kind of junior kingmaker, rallying railway voters to vote for McKinley. Then, as now, the principal issue was the economy. And you may recall that this was the election, a referendum on the gold standard, whether to have a gold-based currency or a silver-based, the famous cross of gold speech of William Jennings Bryan. And Harry Perry Robinson was acknowledged by William McKinley as one of the main factors in propelling him to the White House.
Fascinating. And let's then take him back to Britain, because he became a war correspondent, and he was the oldest war correspondent at the Western Front during the First World War.
He was. He came back to Britain and became quite a prominent journalist of the Times of London. And at the age of 55, which is certainly not considered old today, but back then you were sort of getting a little on in years, and his health wasn't great. But he was one of the first journalists to sign up. He was always very passionate in the cause against Germany, and very patriotic, very king and country and empire. And he leapt at the chance to go over to Europe. He covered the entire war. He was in France, Belgium, and Serbia. And he emerged at the end of the war, his health absolutely broken, but he was knighted for his efforts, and wrote one of the definitive books on the Battle of the Somme.
So now let's look at another of his nine lives, and that's his breaking of the scoop of the century when he reported on the discovery of the tomb of King Tutankhamun in 1923.
Well, this is incredible about this man. So you would think that his wartime achievement and his knighthood would be the peak of his career. But then just a few years later, he is tapped by the Times to be assigned to the Earl of Carnarvon, who, of course, with Howard Carter, had discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun in late 1922. Carnarvon famously struck a deal with the Times for exclusive coverage of the opening of the tomb in February 1923, what we know today as kind of checkbook journalism. And part of the exclusivity deal was that the Times would embed a reporter with Carnarvon to be by his side night and day, not only to act as his kind of press agent, but to preserve the exclusivity of the Times agreement. Well, needless to say, the rival newspapers weren't going to go down without a fight, and it was quite a scrum at the tomb. But at the end of the day, Harry Perry Robinson pulled it off and has never really been given credit for his role in what was the scoop of the century.
Well, I tell you, I think they should make a TV series on his life, because I don't think he could actually cover his career in a single movie. I think you would need this multi-part, many seasons of a television series to get all of his story. But you tell it so well in the book. It's called Escape Artist, The Nine Lives of Harry Perry Robinson. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author, Joseph McAleer. And Joseph, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Described as the greatest Secretary of State for War England ever had, Lord Haldane created the Territorial Army and the British Expeditionary Force and laid the foundation stones of MI5, MI6, the RAF, the LSE, Imperial College and the NUI in Ireland. However, he was forced from office in 1915 after he was unfairly vilified as a German sympathiser. And his story has now been told in a new book, Haldane, the Forgotten Statesman Who Shaped Modern Britain. It's published in hardback by C. Hurst and Company Publishers and costs £30 sterling, so about €34. The author is John Campbell. And John, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
I'm delighted to be invited. Thank you.
Now, Haldane is someone who wouldn't be a familiar name in Ireland, but I'm surprised to discover that he's also a somewhat forgotten and ignored figure in Britain, given that, as you show, he did help to shape in very many ways modern Britain.
Yes, I think you're right. That Haldane did the most marvellous things. But interestingly, anyway, he was a victim of his own approach in that he never sought the limelight. He never wanted to be front of house. He was the brains, perhaps the thinker, the man behind the scenes that made things happen. Yes, he was at the heart of government, but he wasn't the prime minister. So obviously he worked with his contemporaries and friends who were prime minister, people like Balfour, Asquith, Lloyd George, Churchill, obviously after his death in 1928, became prime minister. Churchill was a colleague in government at the time. So in a way that it was through them that a lot of his work was done. But in terms of the impact of what he did and the breadth of his activity, both in peace and war, I myself am the view, and I've encouraged others have now written reviews and endorsements to this effect, that I think that he was, if not the greatest statesman of the first half of the 20th century, he was certainly equal to any of the other great statesmen of that period.
And he had some incredible networks as well. He knew Oscar Wilde and visited him in prison. He hosted Albert Einstein when Einstein visited London for the first time. And wide national and international connections.
Yes. This is, again, an extraordinary feature of the man and the breadth of his wisdom, the breadth of his humanity, that he had all kinds of connections. And you mentioned, let's take Oscar Wilde there, that on the literature side, that he was deeply interested in literature, worked heavily with Edmund Gosse. They together set up the Academic Committee of the Royal Society of Literature. So it was not surprising that in 1895, when Wilde was incarcerated in Pentonville, and a message came to Haldane that he was obviously deeply, deeply distressed, Haldane used the a special pass that he got as somebody who'd been sitting on one of the committees involving prison conditions to go and visit Oscar Wilde. He was his first visitor. And he took with him writing materials. He procured books for Wilde. And he did say to Oscar Wilde, this is a great cause you've now got to write about, writing about being incarcerated in jail. And of course, Oscar Wilde went on to write The Ballad of Reading Gaol, and a copy of that was sent by Wilde to Haldane as an act of effectively redemption, the encouragement that had been given to him. So, yes, in literature, his relationships on the female side, I think, were also very interesting. It started off with a formidable mother who lived to the age of 100, died 3 years before Haldane died. She died in 1925. He had a fantastic sister, Elizabeth, who never married. Haldane never married. And she was his companion for the whole of his life. On two occasions, he fell in love, became engaged one occasion, but the woman, Val Munro Ferguson, broke it off. And then he had a long-standing, deeply affectionate relationship with a wonderful woman, Lady Horner, Frances Horner, who'd been the muse of Burne Jones and appears in a lot of Burne Jones's great paintings. So that he had a great empathy with women. And that then went through into everything else in academia, in the scientific world, of people he was dealing with, J.J. Thompson's and people about Einstein. He was the first man to ask Einstein to come to Britain, stayed with him, with his philosopher friends, his clerical friends, with the archbishops, and obviously in law, which is his profession, and in politics.
Let's talk about his contribution to the British armed forces, because you show how he laid the foundations for many things that helped Britain win the First World War. How good a Secretary for War was he?
By any standards, and this is not my judgment for what that's little that's worth, but the judgment of other great people, he was the outstanding Secretary of State for War that Britain has had. Post the Boer War, The British Army was completely unfit for purpose. And when he first went to the War Office in December 1905, it would have taken 2 months to put 80,000 soldiers into the field. By the time he left in 1912, he put 160,000 people in the British Expeditionary Force in 2 weeks onto the continent of Europe. So he set up the general staff of the, although he developed it, the idea had been introduced by somebody, Balfour, and by Escher a year before, but he developed and completely put into place the concept of the general staff. He created the Imperial General Staff. He created the British Expeditionary Force that went to help to save France. He created the Territorial Army, the officers' training corps that led to the great ability of so many young men to come forward to lead in training and then in the field in 1914. And of course, as you said, he started MI5, MI6, and he set up the Royal Flying Corps as a result of the white paper that he wrote in 1912.
So what on earth went wrong then, and why was he forced from office?
I think more than anything, one's got to say it was the German influences on him, that he was too honest a man to be concerned about what people might think. And when they think in a contorted way, then some great misinterpretations could take place. And the background, I suppose, briefly can be stated as follows. He went to Edinburgh University, but at the age of 18, he took a term out from Edinburgh and went to Göttingen University in Germany. So there he fell under the influence of an extraordinary professor who embodied in Haldane the pursuit of truth and the desire for knowledge, introduced Haldane to the German philosophers. He learned to speak German fluently. He travelled actually very, very regularly in Germany from that age until he went into the Ministry of War in 2005. Every year he'd go to Germany with a great philosopher and historian friend. And so Germany was very, very important to him. Of course, when being effectively the only good German speaker in the cabinet for most of the time he was in the cabinet, he went off as soon as he took office as Secretary of State to meet the Kaiser in Berlin in the 1906 army maneuvers. The Kaiser then came to London on a couple of occasions. He came to have lunch with Haldane, with his generals, and in Haldane's little house in Westminster, the Kaiser called it a doll's house, in 1911. He went on a secret mission to Germany in 1912 and to try to head off the war and come to a compromise over the rate of building of battleships. And so when the war started in 1914, and it wasn't over quickly, there was a great fervour against anybody with any German connections. And John Betjeman's father had a shop in Bond Street, I remember, which they'd lived in Britain for 100 years, and they were Dutch by origin, but there were two N's in the name. So they smashed his windows, and Battenberg had to change the name to Mountbatten, the king from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor. And so Haldane was severely attacked by the conservative press, in particular the Northcliffe press, the Times, because, of course, being he was a liberal, they were conservatives. He'd attacked so many of the things they believed in to reform the House of Lords and all of so many, to reform the army, which there was a lot of embedded conservative interest in the militia and the yeomanry that were swept away in the new reforms. So this was their chance to get back at him, and they got back at him, and Asquith abandoned him.
And that was the end of their previous close friendship. Can we finally talk about his contribution to education? Because, as you show, you know, the foundation stones for Imperial College and the LSE, but also the National University of Ireland in Ireland.
Yes, I'd love to talk about that. Oddly enough, if you go to his home in Queen Anne's Gate in Westminster, there's a blue plaque up on the wall, the only memorial in Britain to him. There's no statue, no busts, nothing. And it says, Haldane, statesman, lawyer and philosopher. But you put your finger on it. I think that if he could have one word on that blue plaque, it'd be educationalist, because his complete love throughout the whole of his life, going back to, as I mentioned, to Lerz in Germany, and the pursuit of truth and of education and knowledge, was supporting anything he could in education, in particular at the university level. So he brought in the reforms of London University. It converted London from an examining body into a teaching body. He created with the Webbs, as you rightly said earlier, the London School of Economics and Political Science in the mid-1890s. He created Imperial College in the mid-1900s. He set up the legal structure as a lawyer at the Privy Council that enabled all the modern civic university structure of England to be put into place. So suddenly one got Bristol, where he became Chancellor, Liverpool, Manchester, Sheffield, Nottingham, Leeds. They all became universities, and Holding's fingerprints were all over them. He led the Royal Commission for the University of Wales, which set up the University of Wales with Cardiff, Aberystwyth, Bangor in 1917-18, I think it was. He was Rector of Edinburgh. He was Chancellor of St. Andrews. And not least, when he was doing the reform of the London University in 1898, where he was giving support to the Conservative Party, that the Irish members of Parliament, it was very important that they should vote in favour of the reform of London University. And they, at the last minute, said they wouldn't do it unless they could have a reform of the Irish universities. And he was dispatched secretly to put together a plan and a bill which could then be enacted to create the National University of Ireland. And he travelled there in October 1898 to Dublin, and then went on to Armagh to meet the Archbishop, Cardinal Logue in Armagh, who was initially very opposed to what Holding wanted to do. But he won him over. And the result of that was that he put together the bill that led to the creation of the National University with its outposts in several cities in what is now Ireland, and separately, obviously, the Queen's College in Belfast.
Well, it's an extraordinary story about an extraordinary figure from history. The book is called Haldane, the Forgotten Statesman Who Shaped Modern Britain. It's published in hardback by Seahurst and co-publishers. It costs £30 sterling, so about €34. The author is John Campbell. And John, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My complete pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book looks at the Irish Jesuits from 1695 to 1811 and is concerned with those who lived and worked in Dublin, and in particular with a central figure, the quite remarkable educationalist and pastor Thomas Beattie. The book is called Irish Jesuits in Penal Times, 1695 to 1811, Thomas Beattie and His Companions. It's published in paperback by Messenger Publications and costs €19.95. The author is Thomas J. Morrissey, S.J. And Tom, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Can we begin by maybe reminding our listeners about the penal laws? How strict were they, and what did they mean in reality?
Well, there was always persecution, if you like, from the days of Elizabeth, but it took a very particular form after the Siege of Limerick in 1691. After the Treaty of Limerick, which at the end of the siege, it was agreed that the Catholics would have freedom of religion under the new rule, under the new king of King William of Orange. But within months, that was violated entirely, in the sense that the Protestant Parliament, which was a Unionist Parliament in Dublin, took over and set out straight away to weaken as much as possible the Catholic population in the country so that they'd no longer be in any way a threat to the minority Protestant parliament and Protestant rulers of the country. They were known as the Ascendancy. So how did they go about it? They went about it by dividing up estates of the larger families who might be possible leaders among the Catholics. The land was to be divided up amongst the members of the family. But if one member of the family opted to become a Protestant, all the land went to him. In other words, weakening any hold of the land. Anybody, no Catholics could have a horse valued more than £5, because anything more than £5 might be used to serve in the cavalry or some such thing. And no Catholic was to be provided with education. No Catholic might teach in a school. The bishops were ordered to leave the country, and the religious clergy, in other words, the members of religious orders. And the idea was, if you get the bishops out of the country, they can no longer ordain priests, and so gradually the religion will die out. That was the theory. In fact, there were 8 bishops, of which 2 left the country, 1 died, and 5 stayed on quietly in hiding. A number of the regular clergy also stayed on in hiding, working quietly in the local churches with the local clergy, and in the Jesuits' case, providing education for local children quietly at night time. And always, of course, there was the problem of the those who were out trying to make money out of the fact that there was money on the heads of the regular clergy. An ordinary priest of the regular clergy, you got £20 if you reported on him and he was arrested. For a Jesuit and a bishop, it was £30. And so these priest hunters made quite a career of searching out for priests, and a number of them were put into prison and so on. So that was all part and parcel of the penal laws which came into operation after the Treaty of Limerick, about 1695, and went on then very savagely until about 1630. And they were criticized by leaders of countries across Europe because they were the most hostile legislation that was ever experienced, particularly involved with people's religion. Any sign at all of danger from a foreign power, for example, meant that immediately the masses were forbidden anywhere. Oh, by the way, part of the penal laws were that no church could be, no Catholic church or chapel could be built on any main street.
And I think the remarkable career of Thomas Pita can only be understood in that context. But can you tell us about his remarkable career then?
Thomas Pita.
Yes, exactly. And these Jesuit schools.
I mentioned Thomas Pita and his companions. I picked 2 other companions who were friends of his, but also who greatly influenced him. It all started with a Jesuit called John Austin. By 1750, the persecution had gone down a fair bit. So John Austin came back from Europe and served in St. Michael's Church, which was roughly where Merchant's Quay Church is now, and started a school in a place called Saul's Court off Shamble Street. And who was it for? It was for local children, but generally from fairly good families, because they intended their son to go on into Europe and to get on there and perhaps become a priest there, or maybe a military career or whatever. But to get on, they needed Latin, because Latin was the language that carried you throughout Europe. And so Austin started what was known as a classical school. And among his students was Thomas Pita, and another man called Philip Mulcahy. And both of those later, they went to the continent themselves, experienced the hostility that there was against the Jesuits in the continent at the time, leading up to their suppression, came back to Ireland and joined Austin in the school. And Mulcahy then worked on the north side of the Liffey, and St. Michael's Church was where he operated. And he set up schools on that side of the river for young boys and young girls, poorer boys and poor girls, free schools. And again, of course, John Austin School was a free school as well.
And some remarkable students were educated there, including the future Archbishop of Dublin, Daniel Murray, and the founder of Clongowes Wood, Father Peter Kenny.
That's right. And also the Bishop of Meath, who was a great friend of Bitter's. So it had a tremendous influence that way, and a whole lot of people in the Dublin diocese who were also... It's because it served as a seminary for the Dublin diocese and for the Meath diocese as time went on. The extraordinary thing as the years went by was that Bitter, night after night, would, you know, come to his schools. He established 5 other schools, by the way, for the poorer children of Dublin on the south side. And all of them in various locations, generally hidden away in cellars and so on. And he would come there every night, and particularly as he got older, it was more and more difficult because he was crippled with arthritis, so that he developed quite a bent-over appearance with his head lower than his shoulders. And he also had a painful hernia. And yet he stuck at that for more than 40 years and was also famous for his sermons and lectures in the St. Michael's Church. And he used to also help people with their wills and their marriages and so forth. Extraordinary thing about it, too, was that he managed out of whatever bit of money he had as a curate to clothe 40 students every year of those who came to him, and estimated that over 3,000 students or pupils were from poor homes were educated by Bitter. And his reputation widespread throughout the city was quite remarkable, something it's almost impossible to imagine nowadays.
And the book definitely brings the life of Thomas Betta and the world in which he lived in vividly to life. It's called Irish Jesuits in Penal Times, 1695 to 1811, Thomas Betta and His Companions. It's published in paperback by Messenger Publications and costs €19.95. The author, Thomas J. Morrissey, SJ. And thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all. Thanks.
We'll be back with more on Talking History right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new collection of essays reveals the history of books in all their various forms, from the ancient world to the digital present. And in this way, it offers an incisive and stimulating insight into the relationship between books and the story of their times. The book is called The Oxford Illustrated History of the Book. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £30 sterling, so about €34. The author is James Raven. And James, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Can we begin by defining or trying to define what exactly is a book? Because we might for a long time have felt that we knew what a book was, but things like Kindle have changed that definition.
Well, exactly. And that in one respect is the starting point for this book, because we do think we know really, or perhaps we thought we knew what a book was. It is what actually is technically called a codex. That is a series of pages which are held together by a spine and usually made of paper. And usually printed. But when you start to think about it, well, there are manuscript books, like the Book of Kells, of course, in Dublin, going back many centuries. But then when you start to think about, as you mentioned, Kindle, when you think of the new forms of reading a book online, on screen, digitally, you can then think back into the history and think, well, actually, what is a book? A book is something, in my definition, or the definition of the contributors to this volume, it's something which is legible. Clearly, you've got to read it. And it's got to be portable. That makes it different, say, from a monument or reading something on a wall. And probably it's got to be able to be kept for a bit anyway. Some books, of course, are quite ephemeral, but you've got to be able to sort of keep them. Think of books that have been kept for centuries. And so when you think about that, you think about all sorts of different materials going back 5,000 years to ancient clay tablets, to wax tablets, to bark and wood, to bone, to even things like tortoise shells were used as books. And when you come through to the modern time, you think about the introduction of parchment and then of paper, and now to the modern day too. So you've got all sorts of different materials, different forms of a book, and different technologies which are applied to those material forms as well. So, you know, one can be really adventurous in thinking about what a book is.
And the collection takes very much a global perspective. And when you compare and contrast how things were done in the West with the development of the printing presses and look at what was done in the East, it shows that the West wasn't really ahead of things, even though we perhaps think that it was.
No, absolutely. And the book was determinedly looking not just at different forms and technologies of what a book might be, but also to look all around the world, to East Asia, to China, Japan and Korea, but also to Southern Asia and also to Central America and even to North America, to parts of the world, Africa as well, which get really, really ignored. And not only can you see all sorts of different material forms for a book, think of, for example, the use of leaves in palm leaves and the like to create books in South Asia, in India and in Sri Lanka, and all sorts of other materials, buffalo skins in North America, for example, knotted strings that the Incas used as a form of book, and all the different uses that there are. But as you just said, yep, they also make us, they pull us up a bit and think, well, actually, we weren't really so much far ahead of the game. And there are all sorts of fascinating comparisons, particularly about the efficiency and productivity of printing, for example, which really originated in the East rather than the West and was a different form of printing, using wood blocks rather than the movable print, which we will associate with the introduction of printing in the 15th century in Europe.
Have things changed in terms of how books are read and how books are received? And has there been a big change in, for example, the types of books, some for entertainment, some for to educate or to instruct people? Has there been a big transformation in why and how books are being produced?
The simple answer is yes, but it's a huge question, an enormous question there, because you've got all sorts of different usages. First of all, you know, why do you need a book? Well, you need a book to record things. And what you're recording might be very humble things to do with the home, to do with accountancy. They might be to do with the change of seasons, as in the buffalo skins that I was just mentioning. But they might also be governmental, or think again of Central America, the recording of dynasties of kings, again in ancient Egypt and the Middle East too. But then, of course, there's an enormous impact of the book upon the world's religions too. So religious books to contain sacred texts, to convey them, and also sort of ritualistic usage of that before we even come on to the vast area of the conveyance of different forms of instruction, pedagogical teaching, and the conveyance of knowledge in all its different forms, and then, of course, in terms of entertainment, which we think probably in terms of perhaps modern books, think of, the rise of the novel in the 18th century, but go way, way back to ancient sagas in Babylonia and the like. So it's a huge question, that, but a fascinating one. And the secondary thing that you asked me there, not really secondary, it's really, really important, that is in terms of the impact of the book, is how those material forms, those different forms, and those different uses impact upon us as readers, how the book was actually used. You know, we all read a book in a different way, and we can all return to a book at a different time in our lives and read it in a different way too. And there might be all sorts of external impetuses to read. Why are we reading it? We're reading it for a particular purpose, or we might actually be reading it subversively. You know, it may be a banned book, about a book that's, the power of these books, of course, is extraordinary, so authorities often try to ban them. And that, again, is an extraordinary comparative perspective that you can see around the world over centuries and in different parts about how church, state, other authorities try to actually ban this book. And so that intersects with the question of what a book is for and how it's used.
And sometimes some books themselves also become history, and they make history.
Well, they do. They do. One can think of all sorts of examples. I suppose the Gutenberg Bible is often thought of in terms of the first really great printed book in the middle of the 15th century. But following that, from the introduction of printing, also the extent to which the relationship between the spread of printing by movable type in Western Europe, the production of vast numbers of Bibles in the vernacular, making history, making the Reformation through Protestantism, but also a huge intellectual revolution as well in terms of the natural sciences and the like, and again, hugely disturbing often to authorities. So making history, but also subverting authority. And you can give examples all over the world of different books which really made it. Think of a modern example, the Little Red Book of Chairman Mao, for example, which is featured heavily in one section of this volume.
I was also intrigued to discover that sometimes books weren't made to be necessarily read, that sometimes they were central to different religions and could be quite significant for some world religions.
Absolutely. I mean, we have books, of course, which are unread for other reasons. You know, how many people own a copy of Stephen Hawking's short, brief history of time and haven't really read it? We've got all sorts of, I'm guilty of that. I'm looking around my bookshelves here in my study in Cambridge, and there's too many books here which I've received and haven't yet fully read. But you're right, the other issue is the extent to which the book becomes sort of totemic, becomes ritualistic. And there's all sorts of examples of that. The book, which is central to a religious ceremony, think of the way in which it's venerated in the middle of many of our church services now, some in the Sikh religion, the putting of the book to bed, in various Chinese rituals as well, the glory of a book which is handed down from one family member to another across the generation. So it has a sort of ritualistic family meaning, quite apart from its efficacy in religious, in worship and in the conveyance of sacred writings.
Okay, well, the book is called The Oxford Illustrated History of the Book. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £30 sterling, so about €34. The editor, James Raven. And James, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cattle, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we'll be discussing the separation of powers as we debate the life and legacy of the French Enlightenment figure, Montesquieu. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking History on News Talk.